Here at The One Thing, we are passionate about getting our principles, our tools, our ideas, our training out to the world. And to do this, we have to create a lot of content. And so we need a powerful platform that can help us manage this content, create courses and podcasts and memberships. And that's why for many years now, we've been using Kajabi. Kajabi is the ultimate all-in-one platform that helps creators and entrepreneurs build successful online businesses by unlocking predictable, reoccurring revenue. So if you're a creator and you work hard on creating content, don't leave it up to an algorithm to determine how successful your online business will be. Look to Kajabi. No matter your niche, Kajabi makes it easy to turn your skills, passions, and experiences into enriching online courses, exclusive membership sites, subscription podcasts, thriving communities, personalized coaching, and more. And the best part? Kajabi doesn't take a cut of your revenue because everything is owned and controlled by you, so you keep 100% of what you earn. Right now, Kajabi is offering a free 30-day trial to start your business if you go up to kajabi.com/one. That's kajabi.com/one. Go to kajabi.com/one and join the creators and entrepreneurs who have made over $7 billion.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the One Thing podcast. We are here today with Guy Kawasaki. You all know him, and yet I'll give you a brief, very impressive introduction. Guy is the chief evangelist of Canva, the host of the Remarkable People podcast. He was the chief evangelist of Apple, trustee of the Wikimedia Foundation, Mercedes-Benz brand ambassador, and special assistant to the Motorola division of Google, here to share insights into his new book, Think Remarkable, 9 Paths to Transform Your Life and Make a Difference. Welcome, Guy. We are so excited to have you.
Yes, thank you very much for having me.
I had the privilege of getting an early copy of the book, Guy, and I feel like this was just like a summation of all the incredible lessons that you've learned over the years from the many impressive things you've done, companies that you've been at, and impressive people that you worked with. Is that what you were trying to build in this?
I wouldn't say all, but many. So I've had this podcast called Remarkable People for about 5 years now, and we figured out that that's 250 hours and 5,000 pages of transcripts, and Nobody's going to read or listen to all that. So we had to take it down from 5,000 pages to about 170.
Well, yeah, 5,000 pages books just don't tend to sell that well. That doesn't usually go over well, Guy. That's not the one I'm picking up at the front of the bookstore.
Yeah, it's although, you know, I just happened to. Oh my God. You see this book? Oh, you see this book?
Oh my gosh.
Look how.
What is that? Now we're going to have to send everybody to YouTube. They're going to have to watch this whole interview on YouTube. That tracks.
And it literally, I mean, you could like.
You're going to get a workout with that thing.
Oh my God.
The question is, Guy, did you read it? Have you read that thing cover to cover?
Every page.
You did?
No.
I was about to be really impressed. Okay, I'm going to tell Seth, listen.
What if Seth is watching?
Well, as you were saying, Guy, you read every single page of that very enormous book, cover to cover. But we're here to talk about yours, so we won't bring that book up today.
Need another podcast for that.
Yeah, exactly. You might need 50 podcasts for that one.
I'll introduce you to Seth.
We've had Seth on. He's amazing. And I don't think we got enough time for that. We have enough time for you today, though.
Okay.
So walk me through the iterations of this book. What I know it prompted you from all these amazing interviews you've had and lessons that you've learned, but what made you decide to put it together in the way that you did?
A big advance. That was a joke.
That'll
You're supposed
do it.
To laugh.
I was just about to say, hey, I would have taken it if that was your reasoning. Not that I think you needed it at this phase,
I'm
Guy,
honest.
But
okay, here's a better answer. The better answer is that I have been very fortunate to have access to people like Jane Goodall and Margaret Atwood and Neil deGrasse Tyson, Steve Wozniak, Christy Yamaguchi, Ronnie Lott, et cetera, Katie Milkman, Angela Davis, and not Angela Davis, Angela Duckworth. I wish I had Angela Davis. And so I kind of feel like I have the access. I was able to have them as guests. So I now have a moral duty to spread their inspiration and information as far and wide as I can, because what good is information and inspiration if it's locked in 250 hours and 5,000 pages?
Yeah, that's true. Well, we could ask Seth.
Yeah, we could. Yes.
Guy, I get asked this question every once in a while, and people ask, hey, what's like the biggest takeaway you've had from being a part of a podcast for years and talking to so many people? And generally what I'll say is that there's it's surprising how there's these commonalities that you'll find between successful people, and how it's almost like the 80-20 rule, like kind of the other way, where it's like there's like 80% of like common ground and then 20% of like this unique niche or approach that people have that makes them really like special sauce. And I'm curious if you've had a similar experience.
Yeah. So, you know, the fact that a book can even be written like this proves that there's a lot of commonality. When many people write books that are compilations of interviews, what they do is they organize it by person, right? So here's the Jane Goodall interview. Here's the Margaret Atwood interview. Here's the Neil deGrasse Tyson interview. And I kind of feel like that is not efficient, because honestly, even a 60-minute interview, not everything is remarkable, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's my job to filter out just the most important stuff so people can get the gist of their lessons very quickly. And then, you know, the next question you have when you organize by interviews is, what happens if Jane Goodall and 50 pages later, Angela Duckworth says the same thing? So, you know, it's kind of odd. Like, I read that before, I'm reading it again. You know, how much of this book is just redundancy? So it would be better to have, like, if they share a common principle, let's discuss the principle and then cite Angela and cite Jane in one place and get it over with. So, if people think that writing a book like this is simply taking transcriptions and binding them together, they're in for a major shock. I mean, it's, you couldn't do it in a harder way than we did it.
Well, you did it beautifully, because you give great stories. I mean, you really have 9 principles that you walk everyone through that are there to contribute to having a more fulfilling life, to having a better life, whether by a little or by a lot. And I love sort of this concept that you bring in. I want to get into some of the principles that I had some takeaways from, but I love this concept that I very much believe in, which is that by putting the person together, becoming a little bit better yourself, that has a ripple effect into the greater world, right? It's, you work backwards from making the world a little bit better by making yourself a little bit better. And yeah. I'd love to hear your journey on that, because I you were obviously a very ambitious person and young person. I think we go out there and we say, I want to change the world. And sometimes you hit your head long enough to realize maybe I should just start with me and then go from there. Were you smart from the beginning, or did you learn the hard way like me?
You know, I first of all, for that young person, if you're thinking, and I absolutely can understand why you would come to a thought like this. Like, if you look at Steve Jobs or Bill Gates or, God help you, even Elon Musk, you know, you think that, oh my God, these people, they're such visionaries, that back in the mid-70s, Steve Jobs had a vision for a $1 trillion company that had iPhone, iPod, iPad, Macintosh, MacBook, you know, Mac Pro, Mac whatever, App Store. And you think, oh my God, I need to have a vision that big. And Bill Gates had OS and applications and games and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But I would make the case that the lesson you need to take from this book is that great companies start by asking very simple questions. And let's take the case of Apple. So with Apple, it wasn't Steve Wozniak asking, well, how can we achieve worldwide domination of devices? He just asked a very simple question, which is, why is it to use a computer, you need to work for NASA, or you need to go to Stanford, or you need to work for Citibank? Why aren't computers smaller and cheaper and easier to use? And he built the Apple One. And you know what? The Apple One, who knew? I mean, you know, he built it for himself. Thank you, God, that there were more people at the Homebrew Computing Club that wanted it. Otherwise, we would not know who Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak are. So I think that, you know, I use a biological example of, These tiny little acorns become mighty oaks. And that's what Apple is. Apple is the mightiest of oaks, but it started from an acorn. And that's the important thing for you to, if you're listening to this, you are an acorn, okay? You're not an oak. But you have the potential to be an oak, and you need to understand that.
Mm-hmm. I think so many people get this backwards, Guy. I think so many people try to start with big plans and in the hopes of an even bigger future, not realizing what you just explained. And you actually, I was going to thank you for taking me here because I was about to go there anyway. You really start with this concept in the idea of the growth mindset. And this is about constantly growing, constantly being on that journey and starting from where you are, which is you're the acorn and you have to continuously grow to become the oak. And you shared a number of stories in this about how you've seen the show up in the people that you interview. But I'd love to hear your journey on it.
So you want the story of the podcast, how it became what it is?
Yeah.
Well, there's two versions, just like there's two versions on when you asked me why I wrote the book. So
give me the real version, Guy. I know there's the one that everybody asks you, but give me like the real version of how this thing happened.
Okay. So the real version is this. I had a previous book. In fact, I have one right here. It's called Wise Guy. And this is more or less all the stories in my life that were formative to me. And this is a five-year-old book. So 5 years ago, I was on a book tour just like this. And I would meet with podcasters. And back then, pre-pandemic, you met in person. So I got to talking to a podcaster. I said, so, you know, just like, how do you make money? He says, well, I sell ads. I said, well, how many ads do you sell? He says, well, I sell one at the beginning, one in the middle, and one at the end. I said, well, how much do you sell them for? He said, well, the one at the beginning is the best one. That's 25 grand. The one in the middle is 15 grand. And now we're at 40. And the last one is 10 grand. So it's 50 grand. So I said, so you're telling me you make 50 grand per episode and you do 52 episodes a year? He says, well, actually, I do 2 episodes a year. So I said, you're trying to tell me you make between $2.5 and $5 million podcasting? She goes, yeah. I said, well, why am I writing a book every 5 years and I like get this advance? And, you know, if I make the advance back, then I get more money. And as soon as I turn in the manuscript, I know there are changes I wish I could make and additions I could make. And, you know, but it's locked and loaded and I cannot really do anything changing it. And from the time I give you the manuscript to the time it's out, it's at least 9 months. It's often a year. And you can sell sponsorships 52 times a year and I can get an advance once. Like, what am I missing? Why am
what
I
am I
only
doing
an author?
Myself?
So that's the day I decided to be a podcaster.
I
the only part
that
I haven't figured out is how to sell $50,000 worth of ads for every episode.
Well, if we figure it out too, we'll let you know, Guy. There's not that many people that are figuring that out.
Yeah, no. And well, I will tell you, maybe you'll agree with this, but the hardest part of a podcast is figuring out how to build the subscriber base. Man, that is hard. Maybe you have the magic formula, but I sure as hell don't.
No, I don't think anybody does. And it's constantly changing. I think I think the way that you grow, as with anything, back to your growth mindset, is that you have to pivot as the world changes too. I mean, I think if you had asked people 10 years ago, probably, I don't know how long podcasts have been around. I don't think they're 10 years old yet, but maybe early on when they were first coming out, there was probably a way to do it. And that playbook has totally changed as of today.
Yeah.
Yeah,
where you find people, how you find people. Yeah, and far more competition. I mean, anybody can make a podcast. You have a phone and a laptop, you're in.
Well, I mean, yes,
the quality
anybody can
is
make
the
a
question.
Laptop, but not anybody can get subscribers. And I just, like, I got to tell you something in a rare moment of humility and transparency. Every day I wake up and say, how the hell does Joe Rogan get 6 million downloads? I don't understand.
Well, I mean, again, that's another podcast. But I think Joe Rogan is interesting because it's a bit of entertainment, too. Like, it kind of reminds me of, I don't know if you ever listened to much radio, but it kind of reminds me of, like, early Howard Stern days. Right.
Yeah.
Like, he was just so different and so talkable that whether you liked it or not, you felt like you had to listen just to be part of pop culture, which is what he's done really well.
Yeah. Well, he's also grown big enough early enough that he can crowd out and saturate the space.
Yeah, I mean, how old is your podcast?
Well, in its current form, about 5 years, a little more than 5 years.
5 years. Yeah, so me too. So, you know, a stunning podcast 5 years ago, I mean, that's like, it wasn't like the great land rush at that time, right? It's like we landed in Manhattan in the mid-50s, and now we got to go find a space to buy. And there's JP Morgan, there's Goldman Sachs, there's McKinsey, there's Macy's, there's Bergdorf Goodman, there's Tiffany's. And like, we just need a little space on Fifth Avenue.
Well, I think you've locked down one of the hardest things, which is getting some incredible guests to come and talk to you. I mean, you have a very unique guest lineup.
You know, I thought that was going to be the hard part. We're going to go down this hole because, you know, when you get podcasters together, it's like, you know, Podcasters Anonymous here. So I was very fortunate to become friends with Jane Goodall. So Jane Goodall was my first guest. And I don't know about you, but, you know, once you have a Jane Goodall, the second guest asks, like, who else has been on your podcast? You say, oh, Jane Goodall, maybe you've heard of her. And nobody ever says, oh, you have mediocre guests. I'm not going to be on your podcast.
Yep. 100%.
And so you get Jane, then you get Margaret Atwood, then you get Neil deGrasse Tyson, then you get Stephen Wolfram. And next thing you know, you got several MacArthur fellows. And after that, it gets easy now.
Yeah.
I can't tell you Michelle Obama's calling me up to be on my podcast, but that day will come.
It'll come, guy. I have confidence. Well, part of it too is again, you talk about this in the book because I think success principles translate everywhere you are, but you talk about one of the things I appreciated in the principles that I think people often miss in books is they give you this like, here's the top 10 ways to be successful, or here's the 9 ways to change your mindset. And what they don't actually give you is any playbook to implement all of these things. Well, like, here's how you actually use this stuff. You got to go do it. And you did. So thank you.
I am innocent of that. Okay.
You are innocent of that.
Yeah. Because listen, I'm a very tactical and practical person, right? So, you know, you read these books and they say, oh, you need to be innovative to be successful. Well, thank you very much. I just paid $25 for that piece of advice. Like, how do you be innovative, right? That's the test. How do you come up with these ideas? And listen, I love bullets. Not in the NRA sense. I love bullets in the sense of in a book. I love bulleted lists. And in particular, I love bulleted lists that start with a verb. So all my bullet list starts with a verb because this is what I want you to do. This is the action. And I'm kind of like obsessive compulsive that way. As you can tell, when I read things with bullet lists and I want to go down, you know, when it says, as you say, if it says 9 ways to make better scrambled eggs, okay, I want to know, all right, you know, don't use too high a heat, mix the salt in the egg and let it sit, use whipping cream, not just butter. Right. I want to know. I use cast iron that's been seasoned. I actually want to know what exactly do I do?
Just tell me the recipe and how to do it.
Exactly. I want a freaking recipe. I don't want a strategic document at the 50,000 foot level. How to make better eggs. Well, buy good eggs. I mean.
Well, I think that it's a testament to I'm getting us back to our podcast rant, but I would offer that a lot of our amazing guests also offer often to refer other people, and they say, who are you looking for? And I'll sort of talk about we pride ourselves on having a pretty eclectic group of people. We want to hear a lot of different perspectives. We want to but my number one requirement is that they have to be a practitioner. Whatever it is that they're writing about, whatever it is that they're talking about, they have to have actually used it. I need to see a yellow brick road to their success in whatever it is. And it's this, which I find to be the one commonality amongst those people versus the sort of theorizer. There's probably a better word for that. The philosopher, so to speak.
You know.
Versus the practitioner, and it's the person who gives the 9 ways to consider your scrambled egg future.
Nikki, you are my soulmate because You know, Madison and I, we have a rule. We never, well, I'll never is too strong. We seldom take quote unquote executive coaches and stuff.
Yes.
And gurus and visionary, you know, and like we turn down about 10 people a day for our podcast. We probably turn down a couple thousand people a year. And so I tell people it's harder to get on my podcast than to get into Stanford. But because, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm sure you get these kind of pitches that I have to let Madison answer these pitches because I'm just so tempted because I get these pitches like, my name is Joe Blow and I run Joe Blow Consulting and I'm 25 years old and I've already built this business into a 7-digit business. And I just wrote a book that's destined to be bestseller. It's called The Blow Way and it's published by Blow Press and it features all my wisdom by Joe Blow. And I need to be on your podcast. And sometimes when I'm toying with these people, I say, so I'm not familiar with your work, Joe. Can you explain to me how that's in the same category of Jane Goodall and Steve Wozniak and Margaret Atwood and Neil deGrasse Tyson? And after that, they go away.
Well, that's one way to do it.
So I've grown. I have the growth mindset. So I've grown out of that phase where I'm arguing with these people and I just refer those to Madison to tell them that.
we talk so much about the importance of saying no, and it sounds like you're just living that. You gotta say no. And you're clear on what your audience is and what they're looking for.
But you know what? I gotta tell you something. Contrary to what you said, I absolutely understand about, you know, preserving your time and stuff. I will tell you that I am living testimony to the goodness of defaulting to yes. Mm. I default to yes all the time. I mean, you know, we're some people may want to know, like, how many subscribers do you have? How many downloads do you have? Who have been your guests and all that? I don't know about your interaction with me, but I say yes to almost every podcast because I figure that one of these days, I'm going to be on this podcast and, you know, Nikki and Chris, you might be on MTV or you might be CNN broadcast. You might be the Wall Street Journal West Coast editor someday. You might be, Joe Rogan might be sucking up to you to be on your show someday. And I want you to remember that way back in 2024, Guy Kawasaki, he didn't bust our ass. He just said, yes, I'm doing it. So I hope you remember that. Okay.
One habit that my wife and I are really proud of that we put in place over the last couple of years is a monthly budget review. Getting on the same page about how we're investing and spending has been a game changer for us. Whether you're budgeting by yourself or you're financial planning with another, it can be tedious. You're pulling together multiple sources of information, updating multiple spreadsheets, but the good news is it doesn't have to be that difficult. That's why I want to recommend Monarch Money. Monarch is a top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. With Monarch, you can create custom budgets, track progress towards financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/onething. What I like about Monarch, it's intuitive. Unlike other apps that I've used in the past, it's simple. The intuitive design makes it easy to set up and customize. It allows for collaboration so you can collaborate with your partner, family, financial advisor. It's customizable, it's customer focused, and it's ad-free. After trying out Monarch myself, I understand why it's a top-rated personal finance app. And now, listeners of this podcast will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/onething. That's monarchmoney.com/onething for your extended 30-day free trial.
I love that MTV was the first thing that came to your mind, Guy. We're going to have to unpack that at some point. But you do.
We're going to have to explain that to you.
We're going to need to come back to that. And I'm moving on for your sake.
That's what happens when you have old guests, Nikki. What can I say? At least I didn't say Fox.
That's true. And you talk about this in the book, which I actually really appreciated because I can find that I can look backwards in my own life. You talk about this in one of your principles. It's called plant many seeds, if I remember it correctly. Right.
Right.
And something I can look back in my own life is is the opposite a bit of what we teach inside the One Thing, to be focused, to say no more than you say yes. And in my youth, which I think is the right time to do it, especially, I said yes to everything. Like, I was like, I want to try everything. I want to meet everybody. And I can look backwards at so many of those things that I said yes to that seemed completely unrelated.
Yep.
That did connect the dots to future big opportunities and successes that you would never be able to have forethought around. Just coincidence.
And you know what? At the time you have to make these decisions, there is no way you can predict their actual outcome and influence in your life.
Yeah.
And, I'll tell you so. Okay, this is a bizarre story. But when I was growing up in Hawaii, I went to a school and I had to catch the bus to the school and bus home. And twice I was robbed on that bus. And also, when I was in high school, some family friend gave me a ride in a Porsche 911, okay? And I'll tell you something. Those three things were fundamental to my success in life, because I came out of those three things saying, Guy, you have got to work hard and you've got to study hard so you can live someplace where you don't get robbed on the bus. And you need to get out of these crappy cars your family can afford. And you need to be able to buy a German car. And so, you know, when people talk about, I'm my goal in life is to end crime or to end poverty or reverse climate change. You know, they want to change the world. All I wanted to do, Nikki, was change the car. And the very valuable lesson that I learned is that it doesn't matter what motivated you. All that matters is that you got motivated. So don't be proud.
Ooh, I love that. It doesn't matter what motivated you. It just matters that you got motivated. Because you did go on to change the world, to do many amazing things. And did you get the German car?
Oh, God, yes, Nick. I overachieved that.
Well, I had to make sure that the advances and the podcast ads were going to good use, at least.
So I'll tell you something. Now that I'm the old guy, right, and I'm driving German cars, I swear to God, I do this. I take kids, family, friends, and, you know, whatever, surfing buddies, kids. Sometimes I even let them drive the German car. I put them in German cars all the time because I want them 30 years from now, they're going to say, you know, back in 2024, Guy Kawasaki let me drive his German car. And oh my God, my parents are telling me I got to study and I got to, you know, work hard. And then Guy let me drive his German car. And I said, shit, man, I want a car like that. So I studied and I worked hard. I'm helping the universe, baby. I'm making a difference.
I mean, I think it's so important. I think we laugh about it. And yet I think that one of the biggest challenges that most people see and that come from people who don't grow up in an environment where they see those things around them is that it's hard to imagine that which you have not seen before. So if you've never been in a German car, it's really hard to imagine that that would be possible for you.
Yeah,
it's really hard to imagine yourself in that position. So it is a gift. It really is.
Yeah, your listener is saying, what the hell am I listening? They just talked about all the practical bullet points and exactly what to do. So one bullet point is get a ride in a German car.
Buy yourself a German car.
Items, everybody listening. Get a ride in a German car. Take your kids out in a German car because, you know, forget all the tiger mom and tiger dad bullshit. Just take them out in a German car and, you know, they're set for life.
That's going to be your next book, Guy. Guy's parenting principles. Forget all that other stuff. Just take him out in the German car.
That's going to be a short book. Now, where were we?
Oh, man. We were talking about planting many seeds. Is there I'd love to hear, you shared those two, but I'd love to hear in your professional life if there was any, like, random seed. Was there one rant that you could have never guessed, but one random seed that was planted that later led to a huge opportunity?
Okay, we can
I was like, I know you got one of those stories in you.
We can stick within the German car
metaphor. I'm sensing a theme here.
Okay, so now, wow, I'll take you all the way back. So in the sixth grade, I was a lower income part of Hawaii's public school system, not the greatest system. So this public school teacher convinces my parents that I had so much potential that I should go into a private school so I can go to college. Luckily, my parents listened to her. They made the sacrifices. It happened. I get to this private school. I get robbed. I take a ride in this Porsche. So I'm falling in love in cars. I get to Stanford and I meet somebody. His name is Mike Boych. And the difference between Mike Boych and I is that he has German cars and I want German cars. So we become friends because of our love for cars. Seriously, he had a GT40. I remember going to his house once in Arizona, and his father picks me up in a Rolls Royce, and then like my head is exploding. And then we go out to dinner, and his mom is tired, asked me to drive her car home, and it's a Ferrari Daytona, right? So now this boy from Kalihi Valley is now being picked up in a Rolls Royce, driving a Ferrari Daytona. Arizona Biltmore Hotel. And so I'm telling you this story because of my love for cars, I became friends with Mike Boych. And because of my friendship with Mike Boych, that's how I got hired in the Macintosh division, because I got hired despite the fact that I majored in psychology and I went to law school for 2 weeks and dropped out. And then I got an MBA. And then after my MBA, I went to work for a fine jewelry manufacturer on Hill Street in downtown LA, okay? So if it wasn't for a love of cars that helped me meet Mike Boych, I would have never gotten the job at the Macintosh division. If I never got the job at the Macintosh division, believe me, you probably wouldn't have me on your podcast. So, I mean, I hope no one listening to this is saying, oh, God had the plan all the time. He was going to fall in love with cars to meet rich people who would give him a job later on. Even I'm not that smart. So you know what? The real lesson is you are a more interesting person when you pursue interests and passions and stuff, right? And maybe it's cars, maybe it's tennis, maybe it's video, maybe it's poetry, maybe it's rap. Who knows, right? But you know what? Just don't just like, you know, just prepare yourself in the Tiger Mom sense to go to an Ivy League school. And I mean, you know, pursue these things that interest you. You just never know.
I think it's also a testament to what a lot of people don't put enough weight in, which is relationships. I mean, I think if there's one thing that everyone could master, it's really that. It opens the door to pretty much everything.
Yeah. I mean, and I'll give you a subtle point on that remarkable people have, communicated to me, which is, it's not who you know. Like, you know, yes, it would be great if you knew Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, and if you knew Joe Rogan, and if you knew Jane Goodall. But what's more important than who you know is who knows of you. That's the key. And if you know that, so now why do people know of you? Well, not because you're a loser, not because you're a crook or an asshole. People know of you because you've made a difference. You made the world a better place. And I can tell you a great story about this too. So I get this job at Apple because of my friendship with a guy who loved cars. And I did well at Apple as Apple software evangelist. I mean, that's why I'm on a podcast to some extent, Steve Jobs' influence. And so 20 years after that, I get this email out of the blue, and this is a woman who runs TEDx Palo Alto. And she says, you know, Guy, I'm a Macintosh user. You don't know me, but I know of you because I use a Macintosh. And Jane Goodall has just accepted speaking for TEDx Palo Alto, and I would like you to interview her on stage. where's the candid camera? Somebody bullshitting me. Like, somebody just offered me the chance to interview Jane Goodall at TEDx. Who would have thought, right? And so it's not because I knew her, the TEDx Palo Alto person. It's because she knew of me, and she knew of me because of my work with Macintosh. So that's the key. It's who knows of you.
And I imagine part of it is you using these principles to grow to a point that people care to know of you, right?
One would hope, yeah. And I, you know, I can't tell you how many times people have said, oh, you know, your book really helped me. And just out of the blue, they helped me or they recognize me. Although I could tell you a very funny story. Are we limited for time here? Because I'm
no.
Not.
Okay. We're here for you, guy.
Okay, I'll tell you a great story about knowing of you, okay? So there have been dozens of times, literally dozens of times, people come up to me and they say, guy, you know, I was lost. I didn't know what to do with my life. I was just floating around and not really doing much, not accomplishing much. And then I read your book and it changed my life. It put me on the right path and I've been successful ever since. And then I say to them, so which of my 16 books had such a life-changing effect on you? And I swear to God, Nikki and Chris, this has happened dozens of times. The answer is, oh, Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Yes.
Oh, shit.
I knew you were going to.
Shit, are you freaking kidding me? Yeah, Kawasaki, Kiyosaki, all sounds the same. We look alike. We sound alike. I mean, oh, my God.
Also a great book.
And he's from Hawaii, too, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Yeah, I mean, you know, we're both married to, you know, nice Haole women. I mean, there's a lot of similarity. although he believes in crypto and Donald Trump, and those are two things I do not believe in.
I had to imagine when you came, even just hearing the last name, I know they're different and I'm familiar with both of your work, but I had to imagine it happens frequently. Now the question is, guy, do you take credit? Like, if are they asking you to sign his book? Do you sign for him? You should. No, if I was you, I would.
No. I straightened them out. Can I tell you another funny story?
Please.
People might not buy Think Remarkable after this podcast, but they're at least going to have a good laugh.
I'm going to highly suggest that they do. It's very good. I'm not just saying that because you're our guest. It really is great.
Okay. So, once again, we're going back to cars. God, people are going to think I'm such a shallow person. But, you know, what you see is what you get. So this is about 20 years ago, and I'm driving a 911, and I'm in Menlo Park, California. And I'm driving my 911 on El Camino, which is the main street in Menlo Park. And, you know, when you're driving a 911, you're basically a smug asshole. Let's just be honest. Okay. So I'm driving my 911 and I look over to my left and I see this car with four teenage girls and they're making eye contact with me. They're smiling, they're giggling, they're laughing. The girl in the front seat says, roll down your window. She doesn't drive a Porsche. You don't roll down your window. You press a button. But anyway, that's a detail. So I roll down my window and she sticks her head out and she says, are you Jackie Chan? So more people know of me as Jackie Chan too. So now you may say, okay, so that's a funny story in racial profiling or, you know, racial whatever. But I'll tell you something, this gets back to the remarkable motivations in life. So ever since then, it's been one of my goals that someday Jackie Chan is in Shanghai or Beijing or Hong Kong or wherever he lives, and he's driving his S-Class or his 7 Series or his A8 or his Bentley or his Rolls-Royce, pulls up to a stop sign, carload of teenagers looking at him, making contact, roll down the window. And the person in the front seat looks at Jackie Chan and says, are you Guy Kawasaki? That's my goal in life. You got to have goals in life, Nikki.
Well, we need to encourage him to sign whatever they would ask them to sign, just like I'm encouraging you. I got a dear friend that looks like an actor, and people ask her all the time, are you so-and-so actress? And she just says, yes, I cannot tell you how many photos she has posed for, and she is no one famous. Like, and it gives me a laugh every single time. And by the way, they're none the wiser. And she's always so nice. She's representing this actor very, very well.
Which actor does she look like?
She looks like Charlize Theron. Like, they could be actual twins.
Oh,
and
really?
I go out with her, and And we also live in Los Angeles, so it's feasible that you would see someone like that. And people think that it's her, and she will take photos with them, and she will smile and make up whole stories. And I'm like, this
you know
is
what?
So
will you
wrong.
Will you have her take a selfie with my book, and then I'm gonna post it as Charlize Theron, a remarkable
loves
actress, loves my book.
I'll get on that guy. That's my homework after this.
That's your homework. That's a bullet item for you.
Will that make you know of me in the future?
Yeah, for sure. I will never forget you, Nikki.
Guy, did I hear you say
God.
That you,
is this
you're a surfer?
All your interviews go?
No.
No, we're just having fun with you. I'm loving it.
Guy, did I catch you say that you're a surfer?
Yes, I surfed this morning. That's why my face is all sunburned. I surfed this morning a couple hours. Yeah.
Okay, so pretty avid surfer?
Yeah, that doesn't mean I'm good.
No, of course.
I love to surf, so how's the surf in Austin?
Unless you go into the wave park, it's minimal to none.
Yeah, watch out for those bats under the bridge, too, when you surf the...
Right, that's a different
Austin
surfing.
River or whatever.
Yeah.
Guy, I have to know if you've watched that documentary. I think it's on Netflix about the 100-foot waves in Nazare. Have you watched that?
Oh, not only have I watched it, Garrett McNamara has been a guest. And Garrett McNamara is in the book. And Garrett McNamara is a friend. Yeah.
How did I miss that? I don't think I remember reading about that. He's amazing.
Well, are you a big wave surfer, Nikki?
I'm absolutely not. And I love to paddleboard and cheer the big wave surfers on. And I am a huge fan of that show, mostly because he's a huge fan of Stoicism, which I'm a follower of. And I started watching that show, and these people are just the most incredible athletes. Like, not only the physical agility that it requires, but that courage.
Oh, it's all mental. It's 99% mental.
Those are literal, like, it's like a building in New York falling on top of you. I don't I cannot compute in my head how they survive it.
You know, there's a lesson in Think Remarkable. Now we pull it back to the book, which is getting difficult here. But one of the things that Garrett McNamara explains in the book, in the growth mindset section, is that you need to face your fears, which, you know, instead of faking it until you make it, you need to face it until you make it. And so Garrett McNamara tells the story that he was afraid to surf in 10 to 12 foot waves, and then his friends forced him. So he went from 10 to 12, you know, to 20 to 25. And then I guess once you're past 25, 100 is no big deal. And his recommendation and his thought and the bullet item is you need to face your fears. And that is a very important concept. I mean, you can apply it. Maybe many of us don't do 100-foot waves. But if you have a fear of public speaking, you need to face your fears and just do it. Because now, going out there, it's routine for him. He's not scared anymore. He's faced his fears. You need to face your fears of public speaking if that's your fear.
Don't you think that that's the case for anything? Like, I've come to believe that everything just sort of normalizes, right?
Yeah.
That everything that seemed scary or hard at one point, or success is a great example of that too, going back to your German car example, that once you're used to driving a German car, that's sort of just the lifestyle that you expect. And once you're used to running a $1 billion company, that's just sort of what you're used to doing. And I think it's the same thing when you face things that are really scary like that, that it just eventually normalizes. Now I doubt he hesitates to go and surf that building that he surfs. and yet it didn't start that way.
Well, I agree with you, but I just hope people listening to this don't take this as us saying that, that there's no danger in it, but B, pretty soon that's a fine line into like delusional arrogance, right? That, you know.
Say more about
that. I'm a billionaire. I'm a billionaire. I'm used to running large organizations. Of course I can do this. And you know what I mean? Like one example is that when you read about these politicians and they leave politics to go run a university, it's like, I'm a politician. I'm a big deal in Washington, D.C. Of course I can run a university. I would make the case that... There is no similarity between those two jobs. And, you know, don't believe that. Don't believe. Well, on the flip side, it's true too that, you know, if you're a billionaire and you run a hedge fund or you run even a company, that doesn't mean you're going to be a good president. Not at all, actually. So, let's not get too full of ourselves. So,
well, it sounds like, I mean, there's a lot of value in facing your fears and doing it often, because it's like there's a specific skill that you build, but there's the broader skill of running into the challenge. But to your point, it's you need to stay grounded as well, and you need to have some, I guess, relativity outside of your specific lane to keep you in the real world. I have a personal experience with it. I grew up around skydiving and did a whole lot of skydiving when I was younger. And the more frequently you jump, the less like intense it feels, right? It's like riding a big wave. I'm sure you ride a big wave every week. The wave doesn't seem so big. You don't ride a big wave for 6 months. You get in front of it, it looks big again. And I think there's just something to that. Over time, though, skydivers I knew that stayed in this sport, they just wanted more intensity, faster, closer, base jumping, wingsuit flying, faster, closer, you know, dead. And so there's something to catching yourself on the path here, like you're talking about.
Listen, I took up hockey because my two sons wanted to play hockey. And then I took up surfing at 60 because my daughter was a surfer. And so what I've done in my life is, rather than force my kids to take up what I like, I force myself to take up what they like. But I will tell you, I have drawn the line with one of my sons who is into wingsuiting. And I want to look good at my funeral. I mean, wingsuiting is just... That's where my growth mindset ends. I am not learning wingsuiting.
Yeah, it's scary. I lose a friend or two every spring, summer season when they open up the passes up in like Switzerland and et cetera. And so it's the list gets shorter and shorter who's still around.
Wow. You know, there's my son once came to my wife and I and he said, yeah, I'm going to buy a used wingsuit. And I have to tell you, we said, you know, son, we can afford it. Please buy a new one.
Just buy a new one. Just buy the new wingsuit.
Yeah, I found this wingsuit on eBay. Yeah.
I appreciate, though, you specifically coming back to this. And thank you, Chris, for expanding on that example, too, because I think it is important to remember that. And I you talk about this in the section of the book that you talk about leadership. A lot of this is skills for you yourself to use. But then also you talk about in the context of leadership that you have to have the skills, not the degree. Right. So back to your point, it's this idea that a lot of people think they're suited to lead because of their pedigree. Right. And maybe I've run this type of company or I went to this school or whatever it is. And I find, and you correct me because you've been around some of the best leaders in the world and some of the most with the most notoriety and probably some of the worst too, I imagine, on that journey as well. I find that some of the best leaders I've ever experienced are ones that work their way through learning that job or elements of those companies and can position themselves as people who have the skill set of the people that they lead.
Yeah, it's listen, I don't think a college degree is sufficient nor necessary to be successful. But having said that, I will tell you that if you are fortunate enough to go to college, I really think you should. I mean, it just broadens out your perspective. It's like, you know, your built-in DEI program for 4 years. I mean, you should do that. I've known a lot of leaders, and I'll tell you, it is lonely at the top for them. It's not a trivial task, and the skills don't always transfer. And, you know, when you read about somebody like Devin Nunes going from politics to running a social media site, like, you just have to laugh, right? Like, you think that trying to get millions of subscribers and advertisers is just like being a congressman. Oh my God. Wait till you see what it takes. That would be like saying a really popular podcast could run a country. I don't think so.
Yeah, I think it might be a little bit different. Yeah.
Tucker Carlson for president. Yeah.
Oh man. All right, Guy. Sadly, I wish I could keep you here for the next 3 hours because you've been a lot of fun. and I feel like you have some more stories to tell. So if you're willing, if you'll say yes to us again, I'd love to have you back.
Oh, yeah. Why not? I mean, because someday,
I was going to say, now you've backed yourself into a corner because you already said, yes.
And someday, I'll make a deal. You get a picture of my book on MTV. Charlize Theron, and I'll come back.
I'll get you a picture with the fake one. That's all I can do for you, Guy. But you can tell everyone it's real.
I'm not going to mislead people. I'm just going to say, here's a random LA fan with my book.
Guy, we always ask towards the end of this podcast, what's the one thing that you would want listeners to take away from, whether it's your eternal wisdom, whether it's the book, any of the books, what would you want them to take away?
Well, I want them to take away that in a relatively serious moment for this podcast, which is, as I said, relative. I don't want you to think that I'm a self-help guru who's written a self-help book. This book is not a self-help book. My fundamental premise is that it's not about putting lipstick on a pig or repositioning yourself or rebranding yourself as remarkable. Steve Jobs didn't wake up in the morning saying, how can I position myself as being remarkable? The way you get people to consider you remarkable is to make a difference. You make a great product. You know, you make a great service. You actually change the world. And if you change the world, and this could be just one person, one team, one classroom, one stream. If you change the world, people will have no choice but to think you are remarkable. And that's the way to be remarkable, is to make the world a better place.
Mm. Love that, Guy. And I think you've given so many examples of how we never really know how these things are going to connect. And yet our actions make huge differences and can change people's lives by giving them a ride in our car.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seriously. And a lot of lives subsequently.
Everybody's going to go to Turo right now and rent a German car and
just start
parenting.
Giving some kids rides around. You've started a movement, Guy. Guy, if people want to connect with you, where can they find you?
Well, it's kind of hard not to find me. I mean, if you want to buy my book, it's at Amazon and, you know, local bookstores. I'm probably most active on LinkedIn. I use LinkedIn as a social media platform. I'm not really active on X/Twitter anymore. So it's LinkedIn is the best way. But listen, if you're really desperate to get in touch with me, my email is guykawasaki@gmail.com. And, you know, there it is. I'm not trying to hide behind anything. There it is. I'm facing my fears of people knowing my email.
Well, the good news is you can always press delete, right?
That's right. Plus, I got Madison.
Yeah. She's there to say no for you.
That's right. That's right.
All right, Guy. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
We'll
drop
a link to the book in the show notes.
Send my best to Cherise.
I will.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the One Thing podcast. If you're a bold risk taker who wants to dream big and achieve a higher level of success in your life or business, visit theonething.com. There you'll find information on one-on-one coaching, our exclusive community membership program, and customized workshops that will help you get your team or organization aligned and rowing in the same direction. That's the1.com to start living the life you've always dreamed of today. Be sure to follow the show to stay up to date on weekly episodes, guest interviews, and more. Plus, we would love to hear from you. Send us a voice note by going to speakpipe.com/theonething or email us at podcast@theonething.com. We'll see you next week.